And moving on to page 39, the muscular system is where we get to learn all about the muscles and how they work, and specifically how they contract. One specific thing to point out is in the second sentence underneath the start of the muscular system in the middle of page 39, it says, however, to complete the cycle of movement production, the body must have a device that the nervous system can command to move skeletal muscle. So the muscular system specifically is the one that completes the cycle of movement production. Winky smiley, highlight that thing. So moving to the structure of skeletal muscle, next on the list, in the middle of page 39. Skeletal muscle is one of three major muscle types in the body. You have cardiac and smooth muscle, but let's learn more about skeletal muscle, which is going to be the ones that you're going to have voluntary movement on that control the major movements of the body and what you're going to specifically focus on as a personal trainer. So moving over to page 40, it's going to go over the structure of skeletal muscle. I do want you to know the difference between the epimysium, paramecium, and endomysium. These are the layers of connective tissue, and the epimysium is going to be the outermost layer of connective tissue that surrounds the muscle body. The paramecium is the connective tissue that surrounds individual muscle fascicles, and the endomysium is going to be the connective tissue that surrounds individual muscle fibers. What the epimysium, paramecium, and endomysium are actually just continuations of the tendon that stretch throughout the entire muscle. So when it comes down to it, you have the connective tissue that form the tendons are actually connective tissue that goes throughout the entire muscle, giving the muscle its shape and form. So if you look up to the right on page 41, you're going to see the epimysium, the paramecium, and the endomysium, and the basically the picture of the structure of how that looks. And yes, you have the muscle belly, then you have these smaller circles, which are going to be the fascicles, or the one individual one would be called a fasciculus. And then inside of that, you have circles as well called the individual muscle fiber, or a single muscle fiber. And we need to understand also the contractile elements of muscle, more just for your own good, in the sense of if someone was to ask you as a personal trainer, hey, how do muscles contract, you would be able to have a nice firm answer, because as a personal trainer, you're going to be expected to know everything there is to know about muscles. So to look on the left-hand side of page 40, muscle fibers and their contractile elements, the sarcomere is going to be the functional unit of a muscle that produces muscular contraction and consists of repeating sections of actin and myosin. So those three words that you just heard right there, sarcomere, actin, and myosin, are going to be the contractile elements of the muscle. And specifically, would be good to understand what actin is, which is the thin filaments, and that myosin are the thick filaments. And the way that muscular contraction occurs is by the myosin heads attaching to the actin and pulling the actin towards its counterpart on the opposite side of the sarcomere. So to get a better idea of that, let's turn the page to page 42 and actually look at neural activation and how that might be stimulated, or how muscular contraction is stimulated. So the contraction of a muscle generated by a neural stimulation is going to be neural activation, and the nervous system is going to activate what's called a motor unit. The motor unit is a motor neuron in all of the muscle fibers that it innervates, and specifically, it would be one single nerve or one single neuron and every single muscle fiber that attaches. In something like the quadriceps, one motor unit or one nerve could attach to literally thousands of muscle cells, because in the quadriceps you don't need to have a ton of control over that muscle, it just needs to contract and relax. In something more specific like finger movements, one motor unit might attach to only, you know, 20 to 25 muscle fibers, as it needs to be more intricate. And same thing with like eye movements and things like that. So it is also important to know neurotransmitters as far as neural activation goes. A neurotransmitter is basically going to be a chemical messenger, and they're going to stimulate muscular contraction. And that's the specific neurotransmitter that you need to know is called acetylcholine, or on the bottom portion of the neural activation few paragraphs, I would like you to highlight the neurotransmitter used by the neuromuscular system is acetylcholine. And basically what acetylcholine does is it stimulates the muscle fibers to go through a series of steps that initiate muscle contraction. And that's going to be from the end of that neural activation section. And I would want you to highlight that, winky smiley. So looking down towards the sliding filament theory, we will be going over that in just a bit, but the sliding filament theory is basically the theory behind how the actin and myosin slide across each other. So we have, we also have excitation and contraction coupling, which is going to be the activation of muscles going to stimulate a nervous system response, which will contribute to more neural activation. And then if you look up at the top right of page 43, we have the sliding filament theory and in table 2.4. The basics of the sliding filament theory is that a sarcomere shortens as a result of a Z-line moving close together. They slide, more or less. And the Z-lines converge as the result of the myosin heads attaching to the actin filament and asynchronously pulling the actin filaments across the myosin, resulting in a shortening of a muscle fiber. So the sliding filament theory is, if anyone ever asks, is just the theory behind how muscles contract or how muscles shorten and they slide, or they have filaments that slide. So looking at page 43, the motor units and the all or nothing law, the all or nothing law basically just says that when a muscle contracts, it will contract, or when a single muscle fiber contracts, that one muscle fiber will contract with all of its force possible, meaning that that one fiber will contract with every single ounce of contraction energy that it can create. If it's not stimulated, that muscle fiber is not stimulated, it won't contract, or there's all, meaning it will contract fully, or it will not contract at all, meaning nothing, the all or nothing law. And specifically, we look at that to understand that when a muscle contracts, you don't contract every single muscle fiber halfway to lift something that's not that heavy. What you do is you actually can recruit individual muscle fibers depending on how much weight you need to lift. For instance, if you are going to lift something extremely heavy, you're as opposed to using all muscle fibers and contracting them fully, you're going to let me say that again. If you're going to lift something light, as opposed to contracting all muscle fibers halfway, you're going to contract a few muscle fibers all the way, which is the all or nothing law. If you want to lift something heavy, you're going to recruit more muscle fibers to lift that heavier thing. And that is how we determine the amount of strength we need to use to lift something, is by recruiting a lot of muscle fibers or a very few, dependent on the movement. So looking at the top left of page 44, you are going to have the excitation-contraction coupling, including acetylcholine, and basically, I want you to know this. This is good because this is what happens this is what stimulates a muscle contraction. And it's something that you could potentially explain to your clients in the future. And the specific steps in the initiation of a contraction, number one, acetylcholine is released and binding to the receptor sites. That stimulates the start of muscular contraction, which is important to know for the test. Two, you have an action potential, which is basically just an electric signal across the muscle fiber, then which reaches the T-tubule, sarcoplasmic reticulum releases calcium once that signal is sent to the T-tubule. Once calcium is there, the active site of calcium binds to the active site, which exposes the crossbridge and the attachment point for myosin to attach to actin. And then you have contraction that begins. And steps that end a muscular contraction would be that the ACH was removed, therefore decreasing the stimulus across the outside of the muscle cell, and therefore the calcium is there reabsorbed and recaptured by the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And then number eight, the active sites are covered, and therefore you don't have any more muscular contraction because the myosin heads cannot grab onto that actin. Therefore contraction ends and the muscle relaxes. So moving in the bottom left of page 44, we have muscle fiber types. There's mainly three muscle fiber types that I want you to know. They first break them up into fast twitch and slow twitch, which we can kind of look at the table 2.5 on the top right of page 45. And type 1 is slow twitch. And typically when we use type 1 muscle fibers is for endurance-based activities. And we use type 2 muscle fibers for power and or short-term muscular contraction. So the characteristics associated with type 1 muscle fibers is going to be more capillaries, meaning more blood flow. That means more oxygen delivery. But they're smaller in size. They produce less force, but they are slow to fatigue, which is a good thing for endurance. And they work in stabilization or long-term contractions, and they're considered slow twitch. And specifically, you'll see a lot of postural muscles being slow twitch because you aren't going to be doing anything explosive with your postural muscles. You're just looking to, you know, sit upright, such as using your erector spinae to sit upright. Those are going to be nice and slow twitch so that you can sit upright without fatiguing very fast. And the type 2 or fast twitch muscle fibers have less capillaries, therefore they have decreased oxygen delivery, so you can't contract those as long, but they are larger in size and they produce a ton of force, but unfortunately they're quick to fatigue, meaning that you can only, you know, run or sprint as fast as you possibly can for, you know, 10 to 15 seconds and then you start to fatigue. But they're really good for, you know, power or short-term contractions or trying to dunk or that sort of thing. So there's two different types of muscle fibers which are going to be or within the type 2 category. There's going to be type 2A and type 2B. I like to think of the three fiber types as type 1 being like a slow twitch, type 2A being a medium twitch, and type 2B being a extremely fast twitch, quick to fatigue. When it comes to like gaining muscle, I feel it's really important to be able to work out all three muscle fiber types by within one workout doing, you know, a high repetition range, doing a medium repetition range, and then a low repetition range, which is going to emphasize all three muscle fiber types being fatigued and used and, you know, torn so that they can repair and grow together. Moving over to page 46, we talk about muscles as movers. It is important to understand the relationship between muscles, that not any one muscle works completely by itself. Meaning that for any human movement, you're going to have a prime mover or an agonist, which I'm looking at table 2.6 in the bottom left of page 46. You're going to have an agonist, which is the prime mover. You're going to have a synergist, which assists the prime mover. And then you're going to have a stabilizer, which is going to stabilize different parts of the body while you do that movement. And then the antagonist is the opposite of the agonist and is basically does the opposite action. So if you were to look at something like the chest press, the agonist is going to be the pec major, so like a push-up or a chest press. Pec major is going to be the agonist. The synergist of the chest press is the anterior deltoid and the triceps. So during a push-up, you also use your triceps and your anterior deltoid, but not quite as much as the prime mover, the pec major. And then a stabilizer would be something like the rotator cuff, which stabilizes your humerus into the ball and or the socket of the glenohumeral joint. And then the antagonist of the pec major would be something that does the opposite, which the pec major does protraction, we'll say horizontal adduction, and the posterior deltoid does retraction or horizontal abduction of the shoulder joint. So next they get into the endocrine system. It's important to know the endocrine system just because when dealing with weight loss, you have a hormonal response that is going to be important. And controlling insulin and controlling glucagon is going to be important in the sense of losing body fat. So those are the main points that I think are important when looking at the endocrine system. But specifically, they go into a lot of detail around the different glands of the endocrine system. And just to kind of point those out, you have your pituitary gland, which is the master gland. You have a pineal gland, your thyroid, which regulates metabolism and hunger. You have your adrenal glands, which might stimulate the adrenaline or epinephrine, which can, you know, increase your strength. You have your stomach, which will process food. You have your pancreas, secretes insulin. and glucagon, and you have your duodenum, that's the start of this, or the end of the, or start of the small intestine, ovaries and testes. And all of these, they produce hormones that have a communication system within the body. As far as body fat loss goes, controlling the amount of insulin that your pancreas secretes is extremely important to body fat loss. And when the pancreas is constantly stimulated with a lot of insulin, that means that you're getting a ton of sweet carbohydrate loads that increase insulin levels. And insulin, remember, is a storing hormone. It wants to store whatever is currently in your bloodstream. So, you know, eating foods that don't have that harsh insulin spike are going to be definitely recommended. But we can get into that further down the road in the nutrition chapter. Another one to point out is maybe the adrenal glands. Adrenal glands secrete adrenaline. When you go to do a workout and you aren't very motivated, sometimes people like to take pre-workouts, which they have things like caffeine, other stimulants that are going to get you more or less kind of jazzed and pumped to work out. And caffeine is one of those that's going to secrete or assist the adrenal glands in secreting a bit of adrenaline, which can kind of get you excited to work out or maybe pumped up or whatever it is that might improve your workout performance. So we talked about the pancreas and insulin, glucagon, and blood glucose control. I'll leave it to you to kind of dive into those specifically if that is something that you have a lot of interest in. But just to go over the basics, insulin is the key to unlock the cells to absorb glucose. Glucagon is released to increase blood, and insulin decreases blood sugar. Glucagon is there to increase blood sugar when blood glucose is low, like in the morning, and like let's say you wake up and then you go to try to do exercise before eating. Glucagon is going to be secreted and go to the liver to secrete stores of glycogen, and that's the way that our body regulates blood glucose. Looking at the left-hand side of page 50, or the top left side of page 50, the effects of exercise. Basically, exercise has a beneficial adaptation on your endocrine system, and that's just the main things that you need to know. Basically, you're also looking at the adrenal gland, pituitary, reproductive, and thyroid hormones. You can go over specific hormones like that in detail with ones that you might be interested in. But to point out one, testosterone. Testosterone is produced in the testes of a male. It's also produced in the adrenal glands, and in the female, it's produced in the ovaries and the adrenal glands as well. The main interesting thing about testosterone is that it's very anabolic, meaning that if you have higher levels of testosterone, you're going to be at a better risk for creating, we'll say, more proteins and new proteins to repair muscle tissue and grow muscle tissue. And also, it's very important because increased testosterone can also lead to a decrease in body fat. So when I talk about hormone regulation and decreasing body fat, increasing testosterone, decreasing cortisol, which is the next one, and regulating your insulin are going to be three really important topics that can lead to increased muscle size and decreased body fat, which is typically some of the major goals in the fitness industry is to lose fat and gain muscle. So, and to go over cortisol specifically, cortisol is going to break down tissue. It's a catabolic hormone. The difference between anabolic and catabolic is that anabolic builds up, such as testosterone and growth hormone, and catabolic breaks down, such as cortisol. And cortisol is it's secreted by the adrenal glands, and its main purpose is under extreme stresses. It will increase your blood sugar so that you might have more fuel to get out of a stressful situation in nature, like you're being attacked by a bear or something. But unfortunately, with the chronic stress of today's society, like worrying about deadlines and working and relationships and having a constant high stress level, our bodies will respond to that by secreting cortisol. And what cortisol does is it breaks down proteins in the muscle and stores fat. So cortisol is not so good, and lack of sleep increases cortisol, poor diet increases cortisol, too much exercise can increase cortisol, that's like you're running an hour and a half, 2 hours a day, every day of the week type of person, or type of exercise. And kind of moving along to the rest or to the end of the chapter, you have your growth hormone, you have your thyroid hormones, and you have the effects of exercise and how they can improve your hormonal levels. Just to read the last chapter or the effects of exercise or the last paragraph, the effects of exercise on page 51, research has indicated that testosterone and growth hormone levels increase after strength training and moderate to vigorous aerobic exercise. And a similar pattern also seems to emerge for cortisol. So while you exercise, you do secrete testosterone and growth hormone, but you also secrete a little bit of cortisol. But if when you go beyond about the hour to hour and a half of straight pure working out, that's when testosterone levels are going to start to decrease and cortisol levels are going to start to exponentially increase. So leaving your training within the hour to max hour and a half or less is going to be beneficial for testosterone production and growth hormone production and keeping cortisol levels low. So that's going to be the end of Chapter 2 book lecture. Make sure to complete your assignment at the bottom of this page, as well as the quiz, and get an 80% or better. So looking forward to see you at the next chapter.